So we began, and I told you that I was going to purposely break this one up because it's really wild how Paul wrote this. In chapter 3 and verse 13, as he kind of wraps it up, really kind of 11 through 13, he talks about the return of Jesus Christ. He just kind of drops it in there. Then it's almost as if he switches gears. And last week we talked about this subject of how are we supposed to live while we're waiting for Jesus to return. And what he shared with us, and we dealt with that in the verse in verses 1 through 8, in the area of purity, in the area of sexual purity, the purity in love, if you will. How do we do that? And so as Paul was looking forward to the return of Jesus, he says, well, in the meantime, we need to live sexually pure lives. And this isn't just for single people. This is for married people also. And so he gave some very practical instructions on how we need to be living while we wait for heaven to get here, wait for Jesus to get here. So he said, I want you to have an abundant life. I want you to have a full, rich life. But I also want you to have a disciplined life where you're being careful in your relationship with the Lord to make sure that this one stays right. Because if that's right, this will be right. And when this is right, and you will be sexually pure. You won't want to let your mind or your eyes or your physical body go other places that it doesn't belong. And so living a life where we are pleasing to the Lord, not pleasing ourselves. And so we found out that in this area of sexual purity, Paul dealt with that in, a very black and white, very practical manner. We learned that sexual immorality is an all-inclusive word that literally means any sexual relationship outside the boundaries of marriage. Marriage between one man, one woman, married together, in that boundary or in those, in the confines of marriage, sexual relationship is supposed to be a beautiful thing. It is supposed to be an enjoyable thing. God left it to be very, very much enjoyable. And so anything outside of that is sexual immorality. Even if it's looking at something or in the thought process, reading about something outside of that boundary, it would be classified as sexual immorality. And so it kind of ruins because Satan is a pervert, and he knows that God left this relationship to be beautiful between a husband and wife, that Satan would, of course, would come and try to pervert that and try to get us to go outside of those boundaries. And so Paul just gave us very, very simple way to keep pure. And so I showed you seven simple, very clear principles on how to live a sexually pure life out of those first eight verses. So if you weren't here last Sunday, you can go next door. You can either get the CD or you can go online and check it out online. But please make sure you know those seven principles because it could save you from getting into a whole lot of trouble. Well, Paul now, where I didn't get to last week and I had hoped to get, he says, okay, if you're, I don't want, this is how sexual purity should be, so I don't want you to do anything outside of that. But let me give you some instruction on how to love properly. And he gave some other instructions. So let's take a look at that, and then we'll finish the inside of the Oreo cookie. So Jesus returning is one side, then we have proper biblical conduct or Christian conduct as the nice creamy filling, and then we'll get to the other outside here in just a second. So chapter 4, verse 9. But concerning brotherly love, so he's talked about sexual immorality, now he moves on to the subject of brotherly love. You have no need that I should write to you, for you yourselves are taught by God to love one another. And indeed, you do so toward all the brethren who are in Macedonia. But we urge you, brethren, that you increase more and more, that you also aspire to lead a quiet life, to mind your own business. Isn't that very, would you say that that's black and white? Sounds like a song from the 50s, if you remember it. And to work with your own hands, as we commanded you, that you may walk properly towards those who are outside, and that you may lack nothing. So as Paul has given these instructions about sexual immorality, or in other words, wrongly using this concept of the love that God has given to us, he now exhorts them how to love properly. So once again, we see this. If we walk in a way that pleases the Lord, so remember this, if you and I are maintaining this relationship with the Lord, if we're doing that, then amazingly enough, loving others should be a byproduct of this relationship. So what I mean by that is that you don't have to go and try to do that. Because how many times have we heard that people say that? Well, I'm supposed to love you. The Bible says I'm supposed to love you. I mean, how does that make you feel when somebody says that to you, right? Well, gee, thanks. I appreciate it. You know, when they say, well, you know, I really don't like you, but the Bible says I'm supposed to love you. You know, I mean, do you think that person has an understanding of it? I think not. Because you almost want to say, well, gee, you know, if it's that much effort, just, you know, why waste the time? But here we see that if our relationship is right with the Lord, loving others isn't something we have to do. It's something that becomes something we want to do, or it should be. So in other words, if we've got somebody in our life, we say, I don't like you, but I'm supposed to love you. You know what that tells me? Something's wrong here. Something's not right in this relationship. And so it can't be something where it's, I'm trying to love you, but you know, you're making it hard for me, Rob, okay? But that should tell us that it's not this relationship that's the problem, it's this one that's the problem. Because once this is right, loving others should be something that is a byproduct. And Paul does tell us right here, and of that kind of love, he says, no limitations, no boundaries. He put up boundaries on sexual morality and sexual immorality, or the sexual relationship. Boundaries, marriage. Don't go outside of that. Brotherly love, pull the boundaries down. Go for it. Love as much as you want. Love as many people as you can possibly do it. In fact, keep pushing the boundaries of that love. Keep looking for new ways, more effective ways to keep growing in your abilities and your desire to love each other. So he pulls out the boundaries. So as we keep our hearts right with the Lord, he then fills us with his love, and then he asks us to take that out into this world, but it got to begin here. We got to be able to love each other first, and then from this place, we go out into the world and we begin to show them what love, true love, really looks like. And so that's an amazing thing. And that's the beauty of it, is that it's not something that we somehow have to force. It's a natural flow of a right relationship with God. So is there somebody in your heart, in your life right now, that you're thinking, person's hard to love? As Thanksgiving's approaching, and you're thinking of who's going to be at that table, are you already thinking, oh my gosh, I got to sit with him or her? You laugh because I just pulled the cover off, didn't I? Yeah. So you know what I'm talking about. So is there a person in your life right now, person that you work with, person that's you find just obstinate and difficult, and you're thinking, I don't like that person. They bug me. You got them in your brain? I want to see some heads nodding here. All right, okay. You got them in your brain? That's the one. That's your guy. That's your gal. That's the one that God has said, that's the one I want you to love. Because see, loving everybody else is easy. We can do that with natural human love. But that one that drives you nuts, that one that drives you crazy, that's the one that God says, ask me to fill you with my love for that person and watch what happens. Listen, I got a list. So, you know, it's an amazing thing. We think that, oh, it's because you guys are easy to love. But it's those people that God puts into our life that says, no, you need my agape for that person. You can't do that one with just brotherly, natural human love. That person, you need me to fill you, because first, in order for that to take place, Rob, you got to let me change you first so that you can then be able to love that person. Does that make sense? And that's what God is asking of us right here. That's what Paul is saying. Hey, you just go for it. But in order to do that with some of these people in our lives, we got to ask God to fill us with love, because honestly, we don't like them. And so that's where it begins. So begin praying now. Okay, Lord, Thanksgiving's coming up. I'm going to have to see them. Or tomorrow in that workplace. Tomorrow in that at the gym or at the baseball field or whatever it is that you're involved in. Ask if you got that one or more people in your life, just say, Lord, fill me with your love for that person. Change my heart towards them so that I can then love that person. Now, once we reach out to that person, if they don't respond, well, listen, your part's done, but that doesn't mean you can say, sweet, now I can be mean to them. That's good. They didn't receive it, so I can front them off and I can blow them off. I can say mean stuff. No, that's not what that means. But if we do this, okay, if we're living in a life where we're saying, Lord, fill me with that love of yours for those that are around me, here's what will happen. It will be seen in what Paul describes as a quiet life. Isn't that interesting? What is a quiet life? For those of us in Southern California, we don't even know what that means anymore. But a quiet life, listen to what it says. It's an interesting concept. It means, he says right there, aspire to live a quiet life. In the Greek, this was an unusual way to phrase something, because it's almost, again, like we've seen last week, some contradictory terms. It means to be aspire. The word aspire literally means to be industrious or to work at. Now, quiet, that's an easy one. It means restful, peaceful, if you will, a life of peace. So what he's telling us to do here, where we see kind of almost like, as we saw last week, a contradiction of terms, he says, be diligent to be quiet. So what does that mean? That means it doesn't come natural to us. If he's telling us, you must put forth effort to live a quiet life, that means we have to put forth effort at something that doesn't come natural to us. So in other words, it is a direct opposition to what the world teaches us as we've grown up. The world, as we've grown up, it tells us, fill your life with activity and lots of noise. And some of us, you know, our insecurity will sometimes cause us to not lead quiet lives. Some of us, we crave the noise. We crave the hustle and the bustle and the activity of life. And yet, here Paul's saying, no, I don't want that for you. I want you to strive. I want you to put forth effort to live a quiet, peaceful life. Put forth the effort for that. Isn't that interesting? So I find it fascinating that, you know, if for some of you, I heard you got to go see the Screwtape Letters. If you've never read the book, I encourage you to get it. If you're here today and you've never read Screwtape Letters, it's an amazing book. You can get it on Kindle and you can still buy it. And it's a story, and it's a tough read, I will admit that. So if you're not into tough reads, then you may not want to do it. But it's looking at it completely 100% the other direction. So you turn 180 degrees to where we as Christians, we say God is the master. So Screwtape is a demon, and he's writing as Satan is the master and God is the enemy. We look at it from this perspective as God is, you know, the sovereign one and Satan is the enemy. So it shows this kind of this weird plan of the enemy to kind of trip us up. We are the people that this is all about, you know, we're called the patience. And so fascinating, in the Screwtape Letters, one of Satan's greatest tricks that he tells them, get them busy. Get them as busy as you possibly can. Distract them with music. Distract them with entertainment. Distract them with anything you can. And isn't it fascinating how well that has worked? Because if you can distract them, you distract them from following on Screwtape Letters, the enemy for us from our relationship with God. And it blows my mind, because as I go out and I walk in the mornings, you know, I love to hear the sound of the mornings. I love to hear the birds. I love to hear, you know, the dogs barking and all of that kind of stuff. But I run into people all the time in the morning that they have the earplugs in and they got their iPads going and they're just listening to all kinds of noise and they don't get to hear the wonder of the morning. And I find it fascinating. Many times, you guys, honestly, you get into my car and there's no radio on, nothing. I like quiet sometimes. I'm a guy that talks all the time, so I need quiet. You know what I mean? So it's an amazing thing. So we have to put forth effort to enjoy quietness. At first, it may be awkward. At first, it's like, okay, it's awfully quiet around here. What do we do now? Man, get used to it. Sometimes put forth the effort. Turn your radio off. Turn stuff off and just let God, you know, just listen to the beauty of this creation that God has given to us. Well, one of the things that we do that Paul tells us to do right here, how you get, live a quiet life, by minding your own business. Isn't that interesting? Mind your own business. We've heard that said. So I find it, if he has to tell us to mind our own business, then that doesn't come natural either. Isn't that funny how we care more about other people's lives so many oftentimes, or we care about what they think of us? And what I have learned is that we think about ourselves a lot more than other people do. But minding our own business, letting other people deal with their own life. You know, in John 21, it's a fascinating, we went through it when we were there. That's the story where Jesus comes, he's risen from the dead, he meets back up with all the disciples. They're up on the Sea of Galilee, they've been fishing. He says, hey, well, they see him. Peter runs, jumps out of the boat, swims to shore, and it's there that Jesus restores Peter. Remember, Peter failed him three times. Here on the shore, Jesus asked Peter, Peter, do you love me? Yes, Lord, you know I love me. Three different times. Play on words. We went through that. But what's fascinating to me is that at a certain point in the conversation, he says, Peter, come, follow me. He gets up. They start walking away. They're walking off. Jesus is going to have a little conversation with him. Peter hears the rustle of the sand behind him. Peter turns around, and it says he turns around and saw the disciple whom Jesus loved following. Sees John following him. So here's the thing. You remember this. Let's just pretend that you're Jesus and I'm walking with you. And my attention's on you. I hear something behind me. I turn around to see what it is. Who have I just lost my focus on? You see what I'm saying? So Jesus then, Peter says to him, but Lord, what about him? And Jesus, you can almost sense Jesus reaching over and grabbing Peter's face saying, excuse me, look back over here, talk to me, look at me, keep your attention on me. John's not your problem. If I want John to remain here till I return, what is that of you? What business is that of yours, basically? You mind your own business. Peter, you follow me. I'll take care of John. Isn't it fascinating? So the next time you or I start to say, but Lord, what about? Just remember, mind your own business. Mind your own business. Hear Jesus saying that, not me. Okay. You don't want to hear my voice telling you that. Okay. But just hear the word of Jesus saying, hey, I'll take care of them. You can't change them. You can't alter them. You follow me. But Lord, what about my kid? But Lord, what about my wife? Lord, what about my husband? Lord, what about this guy at work? Hey, mind your own business. I got him. You take care. You know, I have a hard enough time walking with the Lord for myself, let alone trying to worry about anybody else. So mind your own business. Isn't that cool? I guess it's not, because you guys are not liking that, are you? So, okay. He also tells us to work with our own hands. I like that. You know, in other words, be committed, be diligent to working, to have a job, to have something that you do. You know, to have something that you're working at. You know, it's been rightly said that, you know, an idle mind is the playground of a devil, and idle hands are the tools of the devil. And I think we get that. God designed us. He's a creative God. He designed us to be creative. And as long as we're doing that, it helps to lead a quiet, peaceful life. But have you ever found those people that have nothing to do? What do? They worry about what's going on in your life. They're not minding their own business. They're taking care of everybody else's business. And so, amazing. So, this is how Paul ends the center part of the cookie. Talks about sexual purity, then he talks about loving each other, making sure that those things are done while we're waiting for Jesus. So now, he's going to bring in the other half, and he's going to kind of close up this little Oreo. And on the next part, he's going to give us instructions on the return of Jesus Christ. So he mentions it in 3:13, but then he says, but while we're waiting, let's not forget this. All right, now let's talk about the return of Jesus. So let's take a look as we get into that particular section. And again, I had great struggle over this. So look what he says. I do not want you to be ignorant, comma, brethren. But if you remove the comma, look what it says. I don't want you to be ignorant, brethren. Isn't that interesting? Concerning those who have fallen asleep, that literally means those who have died, but even Jesus uses the term fall asleep because it's basically what it is. Lest you have sorrow as others who have no hope. Before we really dissect and start getting into this whole thing, as Paul changes the gears back around again to talk about the things of the future, and as he will, I felt like, wow, okay, do we just jump knee-deep into this? Or would it be beneficial for us, because Paul was talking to a group of people that had a full awareness. He had just been there and talked to them and taught them about many of the terms that he's going to use and the words that he's going to use in this particular section. And so I find it fascinating that before I can really move into this, I think it's important for us to discuss and to identify and to dissect some of the terms that we use, because then this little section will make a whole lot more sense to us. Because believe it or not, Paul says, I don't want you to be ignorant about this subject. What subject is that? The rapture of the church. And yet, what's amazing to me is that that is one of the areas where the church is very ignorant. It's funny that Paul uses that term, as we found out not long ago when we went through the gifts of the Spirit when we did our summer series, whereas Paul begins that in 1 Corinthians 12, he says, now I don't want you to be ignorant concerning spiritual gifts. And isn't it fascinating that that's where the church has got, and ignorant literally means misinformed, I don't want you to have a lack of understanding. So it's fascinating that in both of those places is where we usually have the most confusion. You know, J. Vernon McGee, that's what I love. If you ever get to listen to him, he's fun. He says, I like to pull the comment or the comma out of that between ignorant and brethren, because he says the ignorant brethren are the largest congregation in the world. And he's probably right, you know. So Paul is addressing, so let's get the context. Paul is addressing a problem with the people that were existing in Thessalonica. So while he was there, he told them Jesus could come back at any time. Jesus could return at any moment. And so that, and then he moves on. And he didn't get to finish this discussion. So it's a fascinating problem, because all of a sudden, in the time that Paul tells them this, and some of the others that began to join into the church, it's been a couple of years down the road. So in that window of time, people have died. People have passed away. So now they're freaking out, because Paul talked about Jesus could return and get us at any moment. So they're sitting there saying, well, wait a minute, Jesus hasn't come back, because they were thinking literally tomorrow or the next day. And truly, it could have been that. So the problem that they were facing is, okay, well wait a minute. We thought he was going to return soon while we were all still alive. Your audience that was here, you've been gone for a couple of years. Jesus hasn't come back. Some people have died. What happens to them? What's going to happen to them? And what is this thing called the rapture of the church, this removal of the church? And so Paul says, all right, let's deal with that particular subject so that it will get rid of any doubt, and it will give the people hope. And so I find that to be a very beautiful thing. Because at funerals, have you ever been to a funeral memorial service where you knew the person there was not a believer? Those are tough, aren't they? As you sit there, and no matter how hard a pastor or a family member, you know, might want to make out this guy to be some, you know, great guy, a good person, you as a Christian know in your heart that guy's not a believer. And you can watch them just try to find some way, some good deed, something out of his past that he did that makes him, quote, deserving of heaven. They're very hopeless things to witness. Because as we learned, you know, a couple weeks ago, there's none good. We have to put our faith in Jesus Christ. That's the only way we get to heaven. So then, have you been to funerals where the person that passed away is a Christian? Whole different ball game, isn't it? Yes, there's sadness. Yes, there's a sorrow because you're going to miss someone, but you know, I'm going to see that person again. I'm going to live my life in such a way that I'll see that person again. It's a whole different story. So to answer this question, what happens when people die? When will this rapture thing take place? What is that? What does it mean? Paul will teach probably, I think, one of the most important Bible studies that he does about that particular subject. So I need to define some of these terms, because we use this event, or we call this event known as the rapture of the church. But what does it mean? Is it a biblical term? Rob, can you prove it? And, you know, what is the stance of Calvary Chapel on this? What do you personally, what do I personally believe on this particular issue? So let's define some of the terms, and then I encourage you to read the rest of this, and we'll dissect more of it next week. But let's define some of the terms, okay? First of all, let me tell you, there are three main ideas within Christendom. There are more than three, but those are the big ones. Within Christendom, about this event known as the rapture of the church and what we will call the tribulation period. So we're going to define these all in a moment. So, first of all, there is a camp that are called the pre-tribulation camp, the pre-tribulation group. You might hear pre-trib rapture people, okay? So, that is the camp that Calvary Chapel fits in, okay? That is where we fit. That is where I personally fit also. That is what I personally believe. That is the belief that the church will be taken out of the world before this event known as the Great Tribulation. We're going to talk more about that in just a second also. The church will be taken out, okay? Then we have what is known as the Mid-Tribulation group. That is a group of people. This is a part of the camp of the church that says that the church will see the rise of the Antichrist. They will see the beginning of this 7-year tribulation period that the book of Revelation, the book of Daniel, talks about. They will see this first part of that, and then in the midst of it, they will be taken out. So 3.5 years into this tribulation period, the church will be taken out. Okay? Then there is a group called the post-tribulation people, and they believe that the church will go completely through the tribulation with the rest of the world. Okay? So I'm going to show you why I am personally of the view of the pre-tribulation rapture group. I'm going to show you why I'm on that. Now, I encourage you to do something. I want you to search the scriptures for yourself. I want you to check it out for yourself, and I want you to come to your own conclusion. I don't want you to believe it just because it's what I'm going to tell you. You can, because it's right, but it's up to you to go do your own work, okay? All right? But if you want to, you know, I really encourage you, because this has created such a division within the body of Christ. It's sad, really. And it's not something we need to divide over. Because I have very good friends that disagree with me on this. And I've agreed to say, okay, but do you believe that Jesus Christ is the only way to get to heaven? Yes. All right, let's agree on that, and let's agree to disagree on the rest of this stuff. And it's okay for us to disagree on this. So you don't need to come and argue with me on your position. You're not going to change my mind, and I probably won't change yours. So let's just say we're brothers and sisters, and we're going to agree to disagree on this one. Does that make sense? Okay? So you don't have to send me any of the emails to show me your proof, okay? So I believe the Bible is very clear. Now, you're going to need to write some verses down, okay? In fact, write this one down. I was going to have you go to it. I'm going to have you go to another one in just a minute. But write this one down next to verse 13, and I'll share something with you. In the book of Daniel, Daniel chapter 12, verse 1. First, let's make sure that we understand there is a day that is called, or a time, a season that is coming to the world that is called the tribulation. It is a time that is coming, that will come upon the earth, that will be more brutal than the world has ever seen in its existence, even more so than the flood of Noah. So the Bible makes that very clear. So in Daniel chapter 12, verse 1, Daniel gives a warning of it, clear back in the Old Testament. Listen to what he says. At that time, Michael, who is the archangel, shall stand up, the great prince who stands watch over the sons of people. And listen to what he says. And there shall be a time of trouble, such as never was since there was a nation, even to that time. And at that time your people shall be delivered, everyone who is found written in the book. So Daniel talks about a time of trouble, tribulation, that the world has never seen before. Okay? Now, you're in 1 Thessalonians. Write this verse down, and I want you to turn to it, okay? Matthew 24, 15. So write that down, and then turn to the left to the book of Matthew, chapter 24. I'll show you something. Jesus gives credibility to Daniel's words as he quotes Daniel in his prophetic utterance about the tribulation also. So Matthew 24, 15. And really all of 24, I'm going to have you look at two places here in chapter 24 of Matthew. But Matthew 24, 15, look what it says. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by who? Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place. Whoever reads, let him understand. So he's referring to a prophecy of Daniel, that Daniel's prophesying of a time that will come yet in the future that is called the abomination of desolation. And what he's referring to, there's kind of two things that took place, but after the first one, nothing of the rest of the book of Revelation transpired. He's talking about a future event where, according to the book of Revelation, the Antichrist, this man that Satan kind of promotes, will stand in a rebuilt temple, and he will stand in the holy place and declare himself to be God. And at that particular time, all hell breaks loose, okay? So he's referring to that. Now, look down to verse 21 of chapter 24. Then there will be, you see what it says? Great tribulation, such as not been since the beginning of the world until this time. No, nor ever shall be. And unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. So Jesus describes, and he uses the term, great tribulation. Did you catch that? A time of great trouble that will be so bad, if God didn't stop it, no one would live through it. So it should be understood that this will be a time that the world has never seen before. Has the world seen great catastrophic events? You bet it has. But that's nothing. Katrina is nothing. The events that we have seen, the fires that we have experienced, nothing compared to what is coming at this particular time known as the Great Tribulation. Nothing has been seen of it before in the history of humanity. More terrible than Hollywood would ever be able to predict it to be or to, you know, to make it to be. So it is a time to come, but so go back to 1 Thessalonians now, okay? And next to verse 13, 14, right in there, I want you to write down Revelation chapters 6 through 19, because that describes this event known as the Great Tribulation period, okay? So you can do your homework on that at another time. We won't get that in depth with it. But let me tell you what happens, okay? What will transpire is these events that is coming will originate in heaven. They start in heaven, and they have corresponding things that happen on the earth. So it's almost as if God pours out something from heaven. It originates there, and it transpires or takes place on the earth. Does that make sense? Okay. So what this means is that this tribulation will come from heaven, and it will absolutely affect earth. as opposed to things that we do to each other that originate on Earth. So, for instance, the bomb that was dropped on Nagasaki and Hiroshima, we look at that and we think, wow, could that have been a part of the Great Tribulation period? No. Why? Because it originated in the man's, in the heart and minds of man, and it went from man to man, not from God to man. Does that make sense? Okay. So these catastrophic things are going to begin in heaven. So now, this is not to be confused, and this is where confusion happens in the church. Okay. It is not to be confused with tribulation that will come to us in the church as we go through times of trouble because we live in this stinking world. Okay? And I mean stinking meaning when trouble comes. The rest of the time it's a beautiful place to enjoy, isn't it? So in John 16:33, you can write that down next to that, because you may need to clarify this for someone or even for your own clarification later. Remember, Jesus said this, "These things I have spoken to you, that in me you may have peace. In the world you will have," what? Troubles or tribulations, okay? "But be of good cheer, I have overcome the world." So some people say, aha, you see, we're living in the tribulation period because Jesus said we're going to have tribulations. Not so. The troubles that Jesus is talking about in that particular section are the things that happen because of our existence in the world. The troubles that come from this world system that we live in. We have difficulties. We have flat tires. We have diseases. We have problems. We have relational breakups. We have flat, you know, tires and car problems. We have fires that happen in our own community. We know that without a doubt. Those are troubles. Those are tribulations that we go through. But they all originate because we live in this planet. Jesus says, I'm going to be with you in the midst of those kinds of troubles. But there's another trouble that's coming upon the earth the world has never seen before, and it will originate in heaven. Satan, the enemy of our souls, nothing but a pain in the neck to us as Christians. We live in a fallen world that was, you know, Adam turned over the title deed, if you will, to Satan. So our trouble and our tribulation right now comes from that. But the great tribulation will be God's wrath, God's, if you will, punishment, his consequence, his judgment upon a world that has rebelled against God, that has rejected God, and has said, we don't need God. That's what's going to happen. So does that make sense? You understand the two different words for tribulation. Does that make sense? Because if you mix those up, that's where people have wrong theology. That's where they get really messed up. So when you get into Revelation 6 through 19, we see seal judgments opened in heaven, where they open a seal and unlock a scroll. And from that scroll, it's poured out from heaven onto the earth. We have the bowl judgments, the trumpet judgments. When the trumpet is blown in heaven, it affects the earth. A bowl poured out in heaven affects the earth. Totally different origin. Make sense, guys? Okay. So the great tribulation is something that is yet to come. But let me tell you, it will come because the Bible says it will. So let's just, what does the word rapture mean? Some people say, well, I don't believe it because that term is not in the Bible, Rob. It's not in the Bible. Well, actually, you won't find the word rapture in your Bible. It is true, okay? But look over, are you in 1 Thessalonians? Look at verse 17 of chapter 4, okay? And have you circle a word. You see the words caught up? See those words? Look at it again with me. Then we who are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air, and thus we shall always be with the Lord. See the word caught up. Highlight that, circle it, do whatever you need to do, and let me tell you what it means. I'll give you the Greek spelling for that word, okay? In the Greek word, it is harpazo, H-A-R-P-A-Z-O, harpazo. What does it mean? It means to seize or to catch away. It literally means to pluck up by force, okay? It means to be snatched away violently even. So in other words, it would be almost as if you were picking grain, where you're walking through and you see an ear of corn, you take it, and you snatch it up, and it's been taken away from that. And that's kind of where the term comes from. You snatch it out. It's taken away violently, plucked out, pulled up. So you got the word harpazo. That's what caught up together, those two words. That's what that means. Okay. So now here's what happens. Okay. When they translated the Bible from Greek to Latin, they used the word rapio, R-A-P-I-O. Means the same thing, caught up, snatched away. That's what it means. Okay. So in the Latin Vulgate, if you were to have a copy of one of those, in fact, Bill, I think you have one, don't you? Bill has one. It literally, they use the word rapio, but they also use the word raptus, R-A-P-T-U-S, okay? Thus, the term rapture came into play from the Latin Vulgate word raptus. That's where we get the word, okay? So it means to be snatched away, to be taken away. So here's the deal. For those people that want to tell me, I don't believe there is such a thing as called the rapture because the word rapture is not used in the Bible. I say, no, you're right. The word caught up is. And you do understand that it means to be snatched away. So, and in the Latin Vulgate, they use the word raptus. That's where the word comes from. Yes, but the word rapture isn't taken. I said, okay, we'll call it caught away then. We won't make a big deal about semantics. See, sometimes people want to not believe in something, and there's the phrases there, the concept is there, the idea is there, but the word may not be, so they disregard the whole thing because they don't like the word. I say, okay, fine, we won't call it rapture. I don't believe in the rapture of the church. I believe the church will be caught up. Does that make you feel better? You see? So it's semantics. So when Paul uses the word caught up, it literally means to be snatched away, and that is a biblical term. It is a biblical principle. Does that make sense? So we know there is a thing called the tribulation. We know there is an event called the rapture. And Paul just told us, I will prove to you why I believe that the church will be caught up, snatched away, before this event known as the tribulation period. I'm going to prove that to you, okay? So the question you may be asking is, okay, Rob, why do you believe it will be raptured or caught up before the tribulation period? And, Rob, do you have any idea when this event's going to take place? Well, let me tell you this much, okay? The church is made up of people who have put their faith in Jesus Christ. So we are the church here. The church isn't a building. Buildings aren't going to be, you know, caught up. People are. So when we use the term church, that means a Christian person who has put their faith in Jesus and is living for him and is walking with him. Does that make sense, guys? Okay. So if the church is going to be snatched away at some point, no matter where you believe that that's going to take place, the most important question is, are you a part of that group? So what do I believe, and how can I prove that the church will be taken before that event is known? I will show you next Sunday. And I will prove it to you next. Oh, that's right, Don Stewart. I'll prove it to you in a couple weeks, okay? So here's what you should do. If you really want to know the answer, read the rest of the chapter and read on into chapter 5, okay? I should have Don explain it to you guys, man. He's an expert in this field, but something's already on his heart. So, listen, guys, the main thing that we need to be aware of is whether it takes place before, in the middle, or at the end, are you ready to be taken up? And the only way that you will know that you are ready for that event, I'm ready. I'll tell you right now, I am so ready. And, you know, I don't know if you guys heard yesterday, but Marcus sent me an email last night. Did you hear where Seattle just put in one of their senators or whatever it is that they have up there, their first socialist to take an office? What position was it that he took? Do you remember, Marcus? For the city council, a city council member for Seattle, their first socialist. And it wasn't something this lady hid. She ran on the platform of a socialist. Isn't that radical? Where are we headed? Are you ready to get out of here? Have you put your faith in Jesus? If you haven't, you need to do that, man. You don't want to be one of those back down here going, well, I thought Rob was a whack. I really didn't believe him. And so now here I am going, well, he wasn't such a whack after all. He was, but he really wasn't in some cases. Okay. Lord Jesus, we thank you. Thank you for this amazing book that you've given to us that gives us hope. You didn't want us to be hopeless. And I can tell you what gives me hope is knowing that you're coming back for me. You're coming back for us. And so Jesus, may we be ready. And God, I pray that if there's anyone here today that's not ready, you would speak to their hearts to make them ready. I would rather be safe than sorry. In Jesus' name, amen.